6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation, the big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night, attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision, high crime treason.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to A Public Affair. It's Tuesday, so that means you've got me. I'm Carousel Baird. I have lined up today, I'm going to say, I was just on the phone with them, you know, acting like a little fan. I'll try and have a normal voice for the show. But this is, I'm going to say, the most exciting show I have had since I have had the honor of being a host on Public Affair. Today we have Dr. Susan Robinson and director Lana Wilson with... Lana created a movie with her partner Martha Shane called After Tiller to talk about what happens now that Dr. Tiller had been assassinated, and how do we get services for third trimester abortion. And Dr. Susan Robinson is one of four doctors in the entire nation that provide third trimester abortion. So Dr. Robinson and Lana, thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, Lana, can we start with you? What made you decide to create this movie, After Tiller, which is showing in Madison?
Sure. Well, the idea really came after Dr. Tiller's assassination in 2009. I was just one of many people who was watching the coverage of what had happened on the news. And I remember thinking, watching the news, that it always said the same thing. It said, a controversial doctor has been killed. Now let's get a talking point from each side of the issue. America's at war about abortion. It was very sensational, very polemical, and very terrifying. And I remember just being so curious about who this man was and what drove him to do a job where he was risking his life every day. But I felt really frustrated that the news media wasn't going into that at all. They were hardly going into the most basic details of his biography, and they were really just sticking to the political talking points on both sides, giving equal time to both sides, that kind of typical approach that we've seen with the abortion debate in the news for so long. So I was curious about who Dr. Tiller was as a human being, what motivated him to do this work in the first place. And then, you know, who else would be left to do it now that he was gone? Would there be anyone left, or would they all be scared away after what happened to Dr. Tiller? And I thought that, you know, no matter what your views are on the abortion issue, you know, wouldn't it be incredibly fascinating and compelling to spend a day in the lives of the people who were doing this work, really on the front lines of the abortion debate, and to see who are the patients coming to them for help and why? Why would a woman seek an abortion so late in pregnancy? So it was really a lot of questions that I was curious about that weren't being answered in the news that drove me to make it.
I remember thinking similar things when Dr. George Tiller was assassinated May 31st, 2009 in Wichita, Kansas, at his church. And mm-hmm. I remember thinking, there's political figures that people have, you know, emotions about one way or another. When they die, you still memorialize them and say they were leaders on this, and you mm-hmm. appreciate the work that they do. And yet when mm-hmm. Dr. Tiller was assassinated, it wasn't, you know, agree or disagree. He was a brave person who put his life on the line. It's not hard to think of how the media should have spoken about him, the way they speak about every other controversial figure. And yet that respect wasn't given to him. It was pretty striking.
Yeah, he was really almost kept at arm's length, it felt like, to me, you know, because the media is such a hot topic that people are just afraid to go into it in any depth, even with the most basic factual information about his life, for instance. And yeah, you know, as you say, he was assassinated in church, and that was one of the initial facts that struck me, the fact that this man, who's one of the number one targets of the anti-abortion movement, was himself a deeply religious Christian, and this was a church he'd gone to with his family for many, many years. That, you know, surprised me at first, and I had to think about myself, you know, what are my stereotypes of who an abortion provider is? Why couldn't they be a deeply religious Christian? So that piqued my curiosity. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, as you say, the fact that he was shot once before in the 1990s, and he went right back to work the next day, the day after being shot in both arms
Amazing.
By an anti-abortion protester outside his clinic. I mean, you know, who would do that? What would drive someone to do that? It just seemed incredibly interesting and yeah, like something that wasn't going to really be touched by anyone else.
Dr. Robinson, Dr. Susan Robinson, you are one of the four doctors in the United States that performs third trimester abortions, and your clinic's in New Mexico.
What? That's correct. It's Dr. Curtis Boyd's clinic, but we work. Shelley Sella and I work there.
How do you get up every morning and do this? And how did you know there was a? I thought there was a really interesting part in the movie where it talked about how all four of the different doctors are interviewed thoroughly, and how they all sort of arrived at the position of performing this service in many different ways.
I just want to start by saying, making a minor correction, which is there are four of us who do this openly. That is to say, if you are a patient who needs a later abortion and you go on the internet looking for help, you will find the four of us. There are other doctors who do it, but they do not do it openly, or they don't do it in a way that's accessible to people. So how do I do it every? How do I get up every morning? Well, actually, Shelley and I swap off weeks, so I go every other week to Albuquerque.
So you don't have to get up every morning.
I don't have to get up every morning. It is the most inspiring work that I have ever done as a doctor. I just wish I had found it earlier in my career. It's a work where patients come in. They are absolutely desperate for help. We know what the problem is, and almost 100% of the time, we can help them. And that is a unique position in medicine. A lot of times in medicine, you really can't help the patient. You can reassure the patient. You can listen to the patient. You can advise the patient. But, you know, you often can't really fix the problem. In what we do, the patients are particularly desperate, and we can fix the problem.
One of the things in the movie, it features so many women that come to you and talk to you, you and all and the other doctors, about why they need this service. And it seems like half of your job, if not more than half, is counseling and listening. And there's this huge therapeutic. I mean, I wanted to jump into the screen and get a hug from you. Can you tell me about that process of your job that it seems less medical than other medical professions?
I guess it's an opportunity to do what I think is almost ideal medicine. In any specialty, I think things would be better if the doctor had the time and inclination to sit and listen to the patient and get a picture of their whole life. For later abortions, we have the patients there with us for 4 days. They go back to the hotel at night, but we see them for 4 days. And we get an opportunity to sit down and chat with them and find out what their family life is like, find out what's going on for them, what their fears are, what their concerns are. And that's a great privilege. It's what Richard Avedon, the portrait photographer, called unearned intimacy. We get to really make a close connection with patients that's unusual in medicine.
One of the quotes from the movie that really moved me is, you said, "It's hard to sit and watch someone be horribly sad without being horribly sad. That's what makes this work so trying."
I think sometimes when many, many people who are having abortions find it very, very sad. They don't want to be there. Of course, no one wants
no one
to be
wants
there.
Abortion.
No one chooses to go to an abortion clinic. That wasn't their life plan. So everyone who is there wishes at some level that they didn't have to do this. you can't take that away from people. That is their truth. But what you can do is be present at and bear witness to their sadness. Sometimes that's the only comforting thing you can do is be present and bear witness. And that's something that all of us are very conscious of. We don't try to talk people out of being sad or explain to them why they shouldn't be sad. We try to just be present and really be open and listen to what they're saying. And sometimes it's quite agonizing because people come from some lives that are so dreadful and so chaotic that really I had no idea that there were people who had to live in circumstances like that. We have women who come to us and they're having later abortions because they were being held captive. And they were being physically abused and held captive, and they had to escape. I had a patient one time whose I forget if it was a husband or boyfriend, but sort of ganged up with her mother against her, and he strangled both of her cats in front of her and said, "This is what's going to happen to you if you try to go and get an abortion." And you know, she sort of escaped. I don't know how she escaped, but it's amazing what people go through.
The level of courage that she must have. Right.
Yes. The fact that some people actually get to Albuquerque bears testimony to the determination and despair that is driving them.
The movie does a lot of trying to sort of talk about the range of people in abusive relationships, people that are young and perhaps were in denial of the fact that they were pregnant at the beginning.
Absolutely. Over half of our patients had no idea they were pregnant until they were well into their second trimester. So right there, that's a failure of comprehensive, age-appropriate sex education in this country. About 8% were led astray, either by the medical profession, on purpose or by mistake, or by those fake clinics, what they call crisis pregnancy centers.
We have them here in Wisconsin.
I bet you do. I mean, they try to set up shop next to pretty much any place they do abortions. And we have had many patients who were lied to by a CPC and told that they were either too far along for an abortion or they were so early they had plenty of time to think it over. Yeah, there are people who didn't know they were pregnant, people who were held captive, people who were lied to. There are young teens who are high achievers, often elite teen athletes, who have a very good relationship with their family, and they're terrified to disappoint their family, and they just are sort of frozen by panic. There are people whose lives are so chaotic that pregnancy is not even on the radar. They're living on somebody else's couch or in a car. Their partner is in and out of jail. They are drug addicts, or their partner's a drug addict. They've got three kids. You know, people come for all sorts of different reasons, and they get late in the pregnancy for all sorts of different reasons.
Lana, I know that with the movie, you don't shy away from some of these really difficult decisions, because some of them, you could see the audience, anyone, most people would agree that someone in dire circumstances that we've talked about deserves access to an abortion, no matter how far they are along. And then there's some women that it wasn't a pressing, immediate issue. They sort of knew all along that this wasn't the right choice for them, but they didn't address it until they get further along. And it's sort of interesting. The movie really makes you think, because you as a viewer, you feel, oh, am I judging these people? What right do I have to sort of make a distinction? And I love how it creates this inner dialogue and dialogue amongst, you know, I was watching the movie with my husband and we talked about it. And you really don't shy away from the difficulties of this in the movie.
Right. Well, you know, we were lucky that all of the doctors were incredibly candid and open with us about all of the complexity to this issue. And I mean, I think that's one of the biggest takeaways, is that this is an issue that people on both sides sometimes tend to simplify, but it's actually much more complicated than anyone thinks it is. It's not black and white at all. It's very gray. And I mean, I think Dr. Robinson, especially in the film, is incredibly articulate about that process of judgment versus compassion, for instance. I mean, you know, it's one thing to say, well, if I was that person, I would have the abortion or I wouldn't have the abortion. But it's another thing to take a step back and to realize that your life circumstances are very different than any other woman's in the world. And that really the bottom line is you don't know where someone else is coming from. It's impossible to know all the particularities and complications of someone's life experience and situation. And every time that you find yourself judging someone, at least for me personally, I make some judgment, then you get to know that person a little bit more and you realize, oh, I had no idea that this had already happened to them. For instance, I remember meeting one patient in the clinic whose decision to have an abortion I was having some trouble understanding. But as I talked to her a little more, I learned that she had been raped once before and had the baby from that rape. She had also once had a child and adopted it out. She had gone through those experiences, you know, and she knew what it was like. She knew herself better than anyone else. Dr. Robinson says in the film that a woman is the world's expert on her own life. And I think that that's a really profound understanding to come to, because it's one thing to say, you know, women have the right to make their own decisions because they know what's right for them and they know what they won't regret, that kind of thing. But to say, you know what, the bottom line is that as a free person, you have the right to regret, and you can make whatever decision that you think is best for you. It doesn't have to be something that a consensus agrees is right. I think that's taking it to another level, and we wanted the film to help people see the decision-making processes these women go through in that way, in a larger way.
Go ahead.
May I just add to
Absolutely.
That and say about regret? A lot of people are fearful that they'll regret their decision, and they take that into account as they make their very complex decision. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Just because you regret something does not mean that it was the wrong thing. I regret that my mother died when I was 19. You know, that doesn't mean that doesn't change anything. There are just things in life that you have to do or that happen, and you regret them and move on.
Well, you make a really interesting point in the movie, Dr. Robinson, about people being storytellers and how all the details that you just told us about, Lana, about this woman who you were wondering why she was seeking an abortion, and then you got to know a little more. It's almost like there's this level that some states have required that there's a reason or a justification for a third trimester abortion. And because of that, you require women to explain themselves. And if they're not articulate or they're not able to or interested in explaining all of this and putting it all out there, that puts them at a disadvantage compared to a woman that can be more persuasive and passionate about her circumstance.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, one thing you immediately realize is that, well, of course, if you're a better educated person, you'll be better able to tell a really persuasive story. I mean, for instance, if you have a higher income, you're usually better educated, so you can tell a better story. And you're also used to talking to government agencies and committees, for instance, and people believing what you say and doing what you ask. And for some low-income women who are having to constantly battle with government agencies for food stamps, for basic health care, always having to jump through hoops and do complicated bureaucratic work and justify themselves over and over, they're often not listened to at all, or it's often in the interest of some of these agencies to deny them, you know, food stamps, for example, and that kind of thing. So they're not used to being even heard. Dr. Robinson, I think you told me one time that one patient said to you, "This is the first time I've ever had anyone really listen to me and not judge me in talking to you." And I mean, I think that really says something. So, you know, who is the best storyteller? If you're a person who's well-educated, who has a lot of resources, and who's used to people listening to you and believing you, you're certainly going to be a better storyteller than others. So it's stuff like that that makes you think of what are the larger socioeconomic forces at work here. And I think it's the cases you're talking about, the ones that aren't as clear-cut or black and white as some of the others, that make you realize all the complex factors that have led to this woman being at this clinic seeking a third trimester abortion today.
Right. There are so many levels of complexity, and it's after a while you totally give up on judging the person. It seems you realize how completely ridiculous it is, because whatever their reason, it was strong enough for them to take 4 days of their life and come and put up with a rather disagreeable procedure. And many of them have traveled from other countries. We got patients from, I had a patient from Australia not too long ago. We get them from Canada all the time. Whatever their reason and however articulate they may be or may not be, it was strong enough for them to come and go through this. And somehow that ought to be enough.
I want to specifically say thank you to both of you because you are their storytellers. And I think that, you know, I'm a sexual assault survivor, and I work with NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin. And I sort of try to, and I'm also a New Yorker, so I'm just loud and pushy. And I try and take my loud and pushiness and say, I'm going to speak up as much as I can, because I know there's women out there that can't. And I have two daughters, one who is loud and pushy like me, and one who is this lovely secret gift that, you know, she's sort of this quiet enigma, and she's just like an amazing thing to me. And I think that she's, anything that happened to me could happen to her, and she would deal with it in a completely different way. And the role and responsibility that, you know, sometimes we sort of have, and I appreciate so much creating this movie, because this movie is the storyteller, and the work that you guys both are doing helps tell the story for all the women like my daughter out there who this isn't what they want to do. They aren't, for them, being loud and aggressive isn't the way to be a whole person. So thank you for that.
Well, that's so kind of you to say, Kara. So what an interesting, yeah, with your two daughters being such opposites, seeing that firsthand. Interesting.
It's fascinating. I wanted to ask you guys about the laws that exist across the state, and especially Dr. Robinson. It wasn't entirely clear, and I couldn't find it on the internet, but were you originally working with Dr. Tiller in Kansas, and now you're in New Mexico? And sort of, can you tell us about the different laws and why you choose New Mexico?
Sure. I actually live in California, in the central coast of California, and back in 2005, I met Dr. Tiller at a conference, and he invited me to come visit in Wichita, which I did, and 2 years, I immediately applied for a Kansas license, thinking, God, if ever I had a chance to work with this man, I would jump at it, because he was such a charismatic and extraordinary guy. Well, 2 years later, he offered me a job. So, I started with him in 2005. And so I commuted. Every third week, I went to Wichita and worked in Wichita. And the reason that we were able to do this work in Wichita was because Dr. Tiller was willing to say, no matter what the state law is, here's what the Supreme Court said about a woman's right to abortion at any time in the pregnancy, if the pregnancy threatens her health or her emotional or physical health.
Emotional health being a big piece of that, yes.
Yes. He was willing to stand up and do this. And in fact, you know, it could have been in any state. It's just a question of how much money you have to pursue this after somebody goes after you in court. And luckily, we had Governor Sebelius in Kansas, and so we knew that there weren't going to be any really draconian laws that would get through the governor. And Dr. Tiller was willing to stand up and say, this is legal and I'm going to do it. But Kansas, since he was killed, Kansas has passed very restrictive laws. And I suppose somebody else could come along and do the same thing, but, you know, say, look, here's what Roe versus Wade actually said, and I'm going to, in my judgment, this pregnancy threatens this woman's health, and I'm going to do an abortion for her. Sometimes you have to pick your battles, and there are other states where the laws are not nearly as restrictive, so you don't have to spend all your time and energy fighting with the state government and the local government. And it happens that New Mexico is one of those states. Actually, there are 9 states that do not have a legal gestational age limit. But those are not states. The 9 states are not states where any old person can just do a late abortion. For example, I believe Mississippi is one of them. Yeah, it is. But it's hard to even get a first trimester abortion in Mississippi. So Colorado is one where there's not only there's no law against it, but in fact, it's accepted. And New Mexico is another one of those states. And we had the huge good luck of knowing Dr. Curtis and Dr. Glenna Boyd, who are absolutely committed to this work. We're dear friends of Dr. Tiller's, and who said, basically, if you would like to continue this work, we will add this late service to what our clinic is already offering. And the law did not have any objection to that. Dr. Carhart, who was the third doc who worked with Dr. Tiller, he had a clinic in Nebraska, and they did pass some very draconian laws pretty well to stop him from doing later abortions.
He was almost chased out of Nebraska.
What he's gone through is extraordinary in his career as an abortion provider. But anyway, he opened a clinic in Maryland. And Maryland is not one of the states that has no laws restricting the gestational age at which you can do an abortion. But they are a state where they follow the spirit of and the letter of Roe versus Wade and allow abortions when a patient's emotional or physical health is in danger. So Colorado, where Dr. Hearn is another one of those states that has no limit.
It's sort of fascinating how each state can put these different rules and implications on Roe v. Wade. We are out of time for today. I wish I could talk to you both forever. Thank you so much for all your work. Thank you, Dr. Susan Robinson, Director Lana Wilson, so much to both of you for taking time out of your busy days. And thank you for all the work that you do. And you are always welcome in Madison, Wisconsin. We will. It's really an honor to speak with you. And I appreciate so much the work that you have done on behalf of me and my family and my children's children. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carousel.
Thank you so much for having us.
And now we're going to talk with Jenny Dye, Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin, who was sitting here listening to the interview with me. And let's talk about what life is like in Madison. You know, one of the questions I didn't get to ask them was, and that Dr. Robinson sort of alluded to at the beginning, is there's only 4 doctors in the country that do third trimester abortions, but those are only the 4 doctors that put their name out there as doing it. How hard is it to access healthcare here in Dane County in Wisconsin?
Well, in Dane County, we're really lucky because one of the only 4 provider locations for abortions in Wisconsin is located in Madison. And so for those of us who live here and who might have family or friends or ourselves try to seek those services, we have access. We have geographic access. But in the majority of counties in Wisconsin, people don't have access. There are only locations in Madison, Milwaukee, and Appleton. And so the vast majority of people live hours from a provider. And then even with those geographical limitations, we're looking at other legislative hoops that people now have to jump through, waiting periods, mandatory ultrasounds. Within the past year, as more and more
all been added under the Walker administration.
They absolutely have. And as those have gone into effect, I've been contacted by more and more women who are having to leave the state in order to get abortion services, because the restrictions result in it being harder to schedule, because you have to schedule with the same provider multiple times, for example. And obviously, that's a little bit harder than scheduling with more flexibility in what provider you see.
So what are we, I know that another thing happening tonight, besides going to see After Tiller, there's a local law that's happening on the Madison City Council level to try and take back some of our rights and access to abortion. Do you want to tell us about that?
Absolutely. As you mentioned, we've seen a lot of restrictions under the Walker administration, and we know that, unfortunately, given the makeup of our state legislature, we're not going to have a lot of pro-choice victories and advancements while we continue to have anti-choice control of our legislature and an anti-choice governor. But what we can do is find places where we can protect women's ability to seek access and to seek care with dignity. And so in the city of Madison, we are working to pass a buffer zone law that would essentially, around a clinic, allow protesters to be there with their signs and continue to engage in prayer or in protest.
Protecting their free speech rights.
But would not allow them to approach within 8 feet of an individual going to or from the clinic. So this means that if they want to talk with you and you are on your way into the clinic for any reason, whether you're an employee or you're there for another purpose or you're trying to seek abortion care, you have to be willing to engage in conversation. Nobody can come up and get in your face. Nobody can come up and stand 3 inches from your car so that you can't pull into the driveway, which literally is something that has been reported as happening there. And
that's what I was going to ask. Is that how it is? I've been there before, but when I've been there, they know all the people are coming to watch, and they sort of take a step back. The protesters take a step back.
You know, to be honest with you, it really varies depending on the day and depending on the protesters who are out there. There are some people who are not up in patients' faces yelling at them and calling them names. And those people can continue to do exactly what they're doing today because we do have free speech rights in the United States. But the people who are up in your face, or, you know, one day I had to park across the street from our Planned Parenthood clinic here because I was going to Community Action, which is around the corner, and that was the closest parking spot. And immediately upon getting out of my car, I was surrounded by people. And that, whether or not you are there to get an abortion, is intimidating to just be surrounded by people immediately upon leaving your car. And so those types of actions are no longer going to be allowable. And they're really about protecting privacy and protecting patient dignity. Apparently, I can't say that today.
That's okay. I fumble every show. But I think that ties into what we were talking about earlier about you have to be a good storyteller. It's not the same, but you have to. I hate the idea that you have to have a certain personality and you have to be someone that is okay being aggressive to get the rights that you need. I find that really insulting that only certain women are going to be able to push through that emotionally, physically, and that every other woman is being left behind. And this law is trying to change that.
It is. And, you know, we're starting here in Madison, but it's certainly something that we want to look at doing in other communities as well. And there are other states and municipalities across the country that are adopting similar laws. In fact, ours is modeled off of a law in Colorado that has been upheld after challenges on free speech grounds, that this does strike a proper balance between free speech rights and the ability for patients to access care with dignity. and privacy. And so that's one thing that we're doing. The other thing that we're doing, again, here in Dane County is the Dane County Board last week, and some supervisors introduced a resolution in support of the Women's Health Protection Act, which I think really goes to one of the comments that was made in the first half of this show, that your ability to access care right now depends on where you live and what state you live in and what community you live in. And that's really not okay. We can't have people be second-class citizens in terms of their access to health care in this country, in any state. And so the Women's Health Protection Act is a proposal before Congress right now that would really set a national standard for access and make sure that whether or not you can access care and whether or not you have to jump through a bunch of additional hoops that are set by a state legislature does not depend on what your zip code is.
And what is there anything that we can tell our viewers that they can do today? So is the city council vote this evening?
The city council vote is this evening. If you want to send a message in support, you can send it to allalders@cityofmadison.com. And we definitely will be putting out more information on the Dane County measure as that continues to move forward. So you can check out and sign up for NARAL's email list at prochoicewisconsin.org.
This still has committees to go through and a couple of steps on the county level before it gets before the county board.
Correct. It was just introduced last Thursday, so it's still pretty brand new.
So do you feel, I know we had, Jenny, you were last on our show, on our end of the year show, where we talked about what makes you happy and where are we moving forward. Do you feel that there, we talked about bearing witness and moving the conversation forward and people getting more involved, sort of a backlash to all the things that are being taken away. It's putting abortion rights and the pro-choice movement a little bit in the media because of all the things that are being done to these to limit women their ability to access these rights. Do you feel that that momentum still exists?
I absolutely do, and I think we're going to see it more and more as we get closer to 2014 elections, and people have to answer to the people in their districts for the votes that they've taken. I don't think that women's groups, including NARAL, are going to be sitting this one out. We're going to be vocal about the decisions that have been made and the impacts that they have had. And I think one thing that goes along with what you were talking about is we are putting women back in the conversation in a way that I think women haven't been a part of the conversation when we just talk about pro-choice versus, you know, the pro-life label. And we talk about the issue of abortion as this clinical procedure. This is about women's lives, and it's about really personal decisions and really personal stories that we don't know for each woman. And we need to do two things. We need to make sure that women have the space and the ability to make those personal decisions. And then we need to work on making sure that they have the ability to talk about their truths if they want to without feeling that shame and judgment. And so we've got a ways to go to work on those, but it is definitely both a challenging time, but also a time with a lot of opportunity to move this forward.
And if people want to get involved, what's the NARAL website again?
It's prochoicewisconsin.org.
Of course, they can look it up as well. Well, thank you so much, Jenny Dye, Executive Director of NARAL, Pro-Choice Wisconsin. It's really good to sort of, you know, that's sort of the mission, is to have a conversation, the mission of the show, and then to figure out how can we move it forward and what are we doing. So hopefully we can connect our listeners to the great work that NARAL is doing to help move this conversation forward. I thank you so much for your leadership and all the work that you do every day.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to be on today to talk about the work we're doing and for the important conversation about abortion in general and the work of the providers featured in After Tiller.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
I won't be sitting there watching the movie, unfortunately, because I will be at the Madison Common Council supporting
That's right.
our buffer zone legislation.